Dave Pryor. Welcome to the Reluctant Agilist. This week, we're doing student QA, and Eric Tucker is here. Eric, thank you for taking time out of your evening.
My pleasure, Dave. How you doing?
I'm doing good. You are in Carolina, North Carolina.
Yep.
But you're from?
Boston.
Boston. Okay. And you support?
You're going to make me do this?
Yeah, we're going to do it because PMI is based in Philadelphia. Go Eagles.
Oh, boy. All right. Yes, I am a diehard, born and raised Patriots fan. I went to my first game in 1976. What else do you want to know?
That's good. We're done. Thank you. All right. So Eric and I have worked together quite a bit. We've taught a bunch of classes together and we've never done a podcast together though. So I thought it would be cool to start out with this question from students. And I had two that kind of fit really good together. So we're going to focus on the area of what happens when you have a sprint and people start trying to jam stuff into it. So one question was, what is the best way to inject defects into a sprint? And the second question was, how do you reset expectations with stakeholders if you're going to fail a sprint? So let's start with injecting work into a sprint. What thoughts do you have on this?
Well, the first thought is you're kind of violating a major rule of Scrum when you do that. Injecting anything into a sprint implies that someone other than the development team owns the sprint backlog. And the development team is the one entity that gets to choose what comes in and what goes out under whatever circumstances.
What if they want to inject work into a sprint?
Well, that's a little bit different. And I think that requires a conversation with the product owner, don't you?
Yeah, I do. But like, what if they haven't, I hadn't thought of this until you just said it, but what if they're not done all the stuff they committed to and they want to bring something else in and swap something else out? I mean, do you ever see that happen?
Sure. And my first question is why?
Yeah.
And usually that reveals something. And I find as former Scrum Master and coach, as you have been as well, why is really the right question to ask. Is there some compelling reason you want to pull something in before you've got everything finished? And what I find is when you ask that question, you usually don't get a really good answer. I always like to recommend or advocate that don't pull anything into your sprint until you've finished everything you committed to first.
Yeah, that's good. So, all right, so just for the folks who might not be familiar with it, so the whole idea with this is that in Scrum, the PO asks, the product owner asks the team to work on stuff. The development team decides what they're willing to do and they create a forecast for what will be ready at the end of the sprint. And that is supposed to be protected, meaning that we're not going to change that until the end of the sprint. So the team is supposed to be given the time to finish the work, the freedom to finish it however they want. The PO is supposed to be available for them as needed, and the Scrum Master is there to help smooth the way for the product owner and the development team to deliver these increments of work by the end of each sprint. So if the PO is to come, or anyone comes in and says, hey, can you just add this thing in? They should have already planned to maximize their capacity, right?
Yeah, for sure. And if the team is constantly being, but if the precedent is being set that, oh, well, we can take in that one extra thing because it's just an hour of work, those things tend to add up really fast. And if you start setting that precedent, that kind of behavior is okay. Before you know it, you've got a completely distracted development team who is having trouble reaching their sprint goal.
Yeah. So I want to check in with you. I've seen two models of this maybe that might help. Let's assume that this is something that's unavoidable, which I mean, I think we'd all agree it was bad. If this happens a lot, the team's also not really going to fully commit because they're going to keep expecting to be able to change stuff all the time if they don't like it.
Mm.
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, it's one of my mentors, a guy named Bob Schatz. He's a fellow trainer. In his class, he brought up a really interesting approach to this problem. And he basically recommends that 70 to 75% of your sprint backlog is reserved for building of new stuff, new features, things that are going to delight your customer. But plan for and reserve 25 to 30% of what you believe your capacity is to handle various other things. Oftentimes teams get interrupted by production support issues. We find that if we don't make time to do things like knowledge share amongst team members, then we'll generally not make time for that kind of really valuable activity. And then the third thing was really refactoring code. That doesn't happen enough. And as you know, refactoring is basically tuning and optimizing code without affecting functionality. So planning in your sprint and allocating time for those kinds of activities can really be beneficial for a team.
So what do you, so what is your reaction when you try to cover that in a place that's very kind of, we will optimize our workers like they worked at Ford and Frederick Taylor? You're under planning on purpose.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And obviously the, when I teach a class, I try to put the circumstance forward by saying, how do you feel when you overpromise and underdeliver personally? Right. And generally people feel poor when that happens. And then I come back with the reverse situation and ask, how do you feel when you underpromise and overdeliver? Conversely, that feels much better. So let's say you plan 5 items for your sprint and you really feel like you can do 7 or 8, but you only plan for 5. Scrum has some really nice checks and balances built in to prevent Parkinson's law, you know, filling the work to, or expanding the work to fill the available time.
Yeah.
Because we have those daily scrums and checks and balances in there. And no one wants to go to a daily scrum and say, yesterday I did nothing and today I'm going to do nothing and no impediments. So we tend to want to please the team that we're on, and that prevents us from sort of taking it easy. So when we finish work early, we can pull more in.
Okay. So I guess, yeah, my one exception to that would be if I was a scrum master, I would feel like it was my, and I don't think this is a wrong thing. It's just that my compulsion would be to try to get to the team to understand their capacity, maximize it, and make them meet their commitment every single time. And if I saw them under planning on purpose, that would make me a little bit twitchy.
I think it's all about the context though, right? So if you're under planning because you're anticipating a high level of production defects in a particular sprint, then that's very different.
Yeah. Okay.
I would agree with you otherwise.
Okay. So two variations, one similar to what I think you and Bob were talking about. I had a team that set aside a certain amount of capacity. They would just block out like X number of hours and per person. And that was based on their historical tracking of how much time were they losing each sprint to those emergency production support issues. Mm. So everybody kept a running total, and they would come into sprint planning saying, you know, I can commit this many hours in the next 2 weeks. And they would have already taken out whatever time they thought they were going to lose, including the context switching for those emergencies. So their capacity for the sprint was reduced to accommodate for those production issues.
I think that's great. And that really shows an embracing of the empirical process, right? They're gathering data. How much did we spend last sprint on things like production support as opposed to guessing moving forward?
Yeah. Well, it also allowed them to track that number so they could actually then go back to management and say, look how much money you're losing every sprint in, you know, productivity by not fixing that broken thing over there. But I think, I guess either that or Bob's thing would work as well. You'd have to track how you're, as long as you're tracking how you're spending the time, I think that's probably the main thing. Then you can make the case for fixing the worn out system.
And you touched on something else that I think is worth raising because, and I'm sure you get this as well. How do we get leadership on board with these types of processes? And even the second question we're raising today about, you know, managing stakeholder expectations when a sprint is going to fail.
Yeah.
I think part of the magic in that is speaking their language.
Yep.
Going to leadership and saying, hey, as you just said, we lost X amount of dollars this sprint, or here's our opportunity cost that we missed because of, say, technical debt or production issues or whatever that we were diverted on and had to fix. Very, very compelling when you speak their language.
Yeah, I think that, and you have to give them some kind of context, especially around stuff like technical debt. They don't know why that matters. It's not sexy. It's not shiny. There was another team. We're going to come back to the topic of expectations in a second, but I want to give this final example. There was another team I worked with that had one person who was sacrificed every sprint. They called him the lamb. And the lamb was sacrificed every sprint to deal with technical debt.
Sign me up for that job. That sounds great.
Well, it rotated. So nobody got stuck all the time. But I mean, it was a great way to keep everybody in sync with this stuff. But somebody was always dealing with technical debt until there was a fire, and they would put out the fire. And that way it never interrupted anybody else. They had a lot of production issues. They had a pretty fragile environment they were working in. So it was necessary, but that was another way to handle it. They just cut down their capacity by one whole person.
Interesting. And you say they rotated, that person was different every sprint?
Every time. Yeah.
That's
nobody,
cool.
Nobody got stuck with that crap job all the time, you know, which is, nobody would want to do that all the time. I don't think.
I think I'd find a particular sprint to be sick a lot if that were me, but okay.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. Good approach.
Yeah. I mean, it was their solution. So What about if you're going to fail a sprint? So let's say partway through the sprint, the team realizes, oh, crap, we're not going to make it.
Well, I think really, I think I would classify myself as a Scrum purist. I think that when I hear situations like this, I go right back to the three pillars, transparency, inspection, adaptation. And if you're going to embrace Scrum, you're going to need to get comfortable with that empirical process. And if you're going to get comfortable with that empirical process, you have to embrace truth. And truth is not always pleasant or easy to hear. So if you are being transparent with your data, if you are inspecting it regularly and inviting others to do so as well, then that becomes an easier conversation, provided you've conditioned yourself for it. I think here, though, a Scrum Master can really be effective if they're particularly adept at coaching, because that's the kind of thing where a Scrum Master can help you through coaching find courage that you didn't think you maybe had.
Okay, so let's say that the team surfaces this in a daily Scrum. Like in every daily Scrum, at the end of the conversation, I do a fist of five. Who thinks we're going to, do you think we're going to make it? Mm-hmm. And if I see anybody showing three fingers or less, I want to stop that, everything we're doing right there and have this conversation. Like, are we not going to make it? Who do you think should be the one to tell the PO and also tell the stakeholders?
That's a question that if I were the Scrum Master, I would ask in an open forum. I would say, who wants to do this? Or does anyone have an idea about how to proceed? Just because, and this is a big thing, Dave, I found this in my days as a Scrum Master. Scrum and Agile sounds great, and this whole thing about self-organization and empowerment sounds great, except for when the chips are down, except for when we're up against an emergency, and then we go right back into that fear-mongering, command and control sort of way of being. And I think that's when it's most important to double down on the agility and your Scrum. I would encourage self-organization, and I would encourage the five values, starting with courage.
And so they would decide. I mean, I guess I would want the whole Scrum team to immediately alert the PO and have that conversation.
For sure. But and ideally, even though the PO is optional at the daily Scrum, ideally they were there to hear it themselves.
In a perfect world, they were. And then letting the business know, I guess, I agree with what you're saying. I think my tendency would be to assume it was going to be the PO, but I can see where they might need some backup from the Scrum Master or a team member. Mm-hmm. I think whoever is going to let them know. Do you agree that you definitely want to let them know before they come to the sprint review?
Without question.
Yeah.
Without question. And that's, that gets back to other things like, hey, do we wait for the daily Scrum to surface impediments? Absolutely not. When it happens, that's when you deal with it right away.
Cool. And also, I just want to mention, since we're kind of on the subject, and it is something that a lot of people seem to get a little bit off, your product owner should be seeing finished work every 2 to 3 days at a minimum during the sprint, and hopefully accepting that work. So they should have some sense of whether or not it looks like you're going to be able to deliver. There's a lot of people I get in my classes, and Eric, I don't know if you have this, but they come in thinking that the sprint review is where the product owner accepts the finished work.
Mm-hmm. It's a huge myth. And I think I want to say out of, 50 something classes in the last 7 months, I've probably experienced that about 42 classes where that's the assumption. Oh, well, in the sprint review, we're going to get acceptance from the product owner. And they say nothing about having a customer there. And I think this really brings up two pretty important points. I agree with you 100%. As soon as a PBI is done, show it. Get feedback from the product owner right away. The idea is we don't want to show anything in the sprint review that has not already been accepted. And secondly, we want to make absolutely sure that we have customers at our sprint reviews. Internal stakeholders are fine. Managers are fine. But I want customers there because there's no substitute for customer feedback.
Yeah. This is great, man. This is perfect. Is there anything else you think we need to touch on with this topic? I mean, we've hit on the fact that you want to definitely let management know as soon as possible, that the team should decide how to let management know. With injecting work into a sprint, that it would have to be a conversation between the PO and the team, but really that shouldn't be happening as a rule. We've talked about different strategies for coping with it. Is there anything you think we're missing on this one?
Well, I think the other last touching comment I would make here is that, if you're going to fail a sprint, meaning you're not going to get everything done that you planned, chances are you got something done. chances are you are bringing some incremental value. And, you know, there's this tendency among developers, at least the ones that I've interacted with, to be nervous about sharing this information because it implies in some way that you lollygagged or, you know, didn't do anything but your best.
Yeah.
I don't really know many developers who purposely tank or don't try to do their best. So there was probably something in the way that needs to be dealt with. And maybe you need management's help to deal with it. So it's easier to say than do, but try to shed that fear.
Yeah, it's a good point. I think, and also, you know, everybody fails sprints. It happens. It's just why? Why are you failing? That's the thing. As long as you learn and get better, then you're doing everything right. I mean,
I think even when you and I were training a class together, I think we failed a couple sprints, didn't we?
Yeah, well, you did.
I did. That was my fault. Okay.
Of course we did. No, I fail in class all the time. And I take it as an opportunity to do that, to just demonstrate to the students, like, look, I screw stuff up too. It happens.
Yeah. It's normal. Yeah, for sure. Cool. Best learning comes from failure.
Yeah, this was really good, man. So if people want to get in touch with you with follow-up questions, what's the best way to reach you?
Well, I'm definitely on LinkedIn. If you type in Eric Tucker Agile Coach or Eric Tucker Agile, you'll find me there. My website is sustainedagility.com.
Okay.
And I love reaching out and answering questions to anybody who has them. This is my passion.
Cool. All right. So feel free to get in touch with Eric. You'll find his contact information in the show notes for this. And dude, thanks a lot for taking time out of your afternoon. It was great doing this with you.
My pleasure, Dave. Anytime.